Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we have a special guest that's going to be coming to us from Palestine. He is Mazin Kumiza, and he's pretty remarkable. He spent his quarter of a century here in the United States. He taught at Yale, was a professor at Yale, and then gave all that up and became an activist and went to Palestine. Now he's teaching there at the University of Bethlehem and other places. He's a remarkable person, but he is going to tell us a bit about what's going on in Palestine and the Israeli situation. He's going to talk about Zionism and the history of that and what that means and how we can make the world a better place. But he gives us a lot of interesting perspectives, definitely one that I haven't really thought about colonization and the history of colonization and putting that in perspective of just what humans do, not excusing it, but what's really going on, and how people can help and make a difference. So let's get into that interview now with Mazin. Hello, Mazin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, I am delighted that I got you to come on. I've been wanting to bring on somebody to help enlighten us on what's going on with the whole Palestinian situation. And when I got your name and you came really highly recommended, I was very excited about it. You taught at Yale before moving to Palestine. Why did you move and what was your passion that drove you there?
So I spent about a quarter of a century in the U.S. I got my education there, my PhD, and then medical genetics, and then training. And I got board certified in medical genetics, and I worked at medical schools at Duke University and then Yale University. And I was active in human rights issues and nonviolent resistance in the U.S., for example, working against the war in Iraq and other places. So I was doing a lot of humanitarian work related not just to Palestine, but to South Africa and Iraq and Syria and many other places. And there was a period in 2007-2008 when I decided I need to move back to Palestine because this is where I was born. And because I felt at the time that this is a place where I can perhaps be more effective, the work in the U.S. is still very, very important because the U.S. is a big power and it is important for what happens in the Middle East even to affect U.S. foreign policy. But I felt that, hour for hour, my time here would be better spent than in the U.S. Gave up a six-figure income to sometimes a zero-figure income and sometimes a three-figure income.
Yeah, it's hard when you go from making a lot of money to actually being an activist because you don't make much. I know, doing these videos, I don't make all that much. So what is your main goal for the region? What would you like to see happen?
Well, as was said by somebody much wiser than I am, is that peace is not a destination, peace is the way. So my main goal is really to just live life in a way that satisfies my own conscience, basically, and do what I can as an individual with humility. We're not very important, each one of us, but collectively we make a difference. And basically, to do my best with my own circumstances, my own knowledge, my own background, to basically do a difference and leave this world a better place than what was left for us. And we are actually, both lucky and unlucky, lucky in being in this place, being part of the Fertile Crescent, where humanity first developed agriculture and civilization, and so forth. Or being in a period of world history where there is some conflict here in the Middle East, but there's also global dangers of nuclear war and climate change that could end this human species that I belong to, basically. So what is my job? My job is to work to affect a change in the direction that we see needs to be done, which is to challenge these problems that we face, environmental catastrophes, war, conflict, greed, and push for what? Push for human rights, for justice, for environmental sustainability, and for the existence of our species, basically. And that's what I do. That's what I aim for. Thinking globally, acting locally.
Can you tell me what that picture is with the three men behind you? Because I know all the viewers want to know.
No, it's just a spoof, I guess. There was this photographer who came, photographed a lot of people here, and he photographed three religious men, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, and photographed them making faces and put them together. excuse me. The message is basically that that all of us don't need to take ourselves too seriously. That it's about humility, I think, and it's about. I mean, that's how I look at it. That's how I interpret it. Maybe somebody else could interpret it that all religions are crazy, but that's another thing. I mean, I look at it as not taking ourselves too seriously. People think three different monotheistic faces, backgrounds, and they're making faces and enjoying each other's company.
Well, that is actually really cool. So now that we have something really light to talk about, let's move on to something a little bit more heavy. Many leaders have been vocal about the open-air prison state of Palestine. How would you explain the real-life conditions for the Palestinians there?
Well, I mean, one of the things, any conflict in the world, is basically what is the root cause of this conflict? What is the conflict about? In medical field, which is my background, I say you have to make the right diagnosis before you offer therapy and look at prognosis and things like that. A little bit at patient history, if you want, and then identify and not confuse the symptoms with the underlying etiology or diagnosis. And the underlying diagnosis, to cut the story short here, I don't want to go through a patient history for your viewers because they can find the history of Palestine in books by people like Ilan Pappe, Israeli historian, who wrote about the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and things like that. Obviously, a diagnosis is that you have a colonial, anti-colonial struggle. You have Jews of Europe who came here to create a Jewish state. And the country that they chose to create a Jewish state in was 97% not Jewish. And so to create a Jewish state, it required ethnic cleansing of the native people. And the native people ended up being refugees. So 7 million of us Palestinians are refugees or displaced people, the largest remaining refugee population on earth. And they are prevented from going back to their homes and lands, whereas any Jew in the world, including converts to Judaism, can get automatic citizenship and live on stolen Palestinian land. This is colonialism. Now, if one identifies it as colonialism, all the symptoms of it, the violence, the walls, the colonial settlements, the issues of propaganda and efforts to demonize the other, can all be put together and understood as such, as part of human history. And I say as part of human history because just about every country on earth was either a colonized country or a colonizing country, you know, so it's a common human phenomenon. And then one needs to look at treatment and diagnosis after diagnosis. is treatment and what the prognosis is, and we can talk about that if you want.
Well, yeah, keep going.
So if you look at all the countries that underwent this process, there's one of three possible scenarios going forward for colonial, anti-colonial struggles. One scenario where the natives win, so to speak, and the colonizers lose. That's very rare. I can only think of a country like Algeria, for example, where the French colonizers packed their bags and went to Europe. Some of them were five, six generations in Algeria. Some of them have been to France, and they went because the natives won. This is very rare, and it will not happen here. Second scenario is where the other way around, where the colonizers win and the colonized people, the native people, lose. This happens usually by genocide. I mean, not completely lose, but because there's never a complete genocide. But I can think of countries like Australia, Papua New Guinea, New Zealand, United States to a large extent, where there was genocide of the natives. There are so few of them that they are manageable, so to speak. Australia has a national apology day where the colonizers actually apologize to the native people for what happened 100 or 200 years ago. This scenario is also unlikely to happen here and is only found in very few countries, maybe five, six countries one can name in which it happened. The third scenario, which is the most common scenario, found in about 150 countries, is a scenario where you neither have win-lose or lose-win. You can call it lose-lose or you can call it win-win, depending on how optimistic or pessimistic you are. But I'm thinking of countries like South America, Central America, Caribbean islands, Canada, Mexico, Southeast Asia, Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, Taiwan, all these countries where the natives are integrated with the colonizers in one country. And they even intermarry and they have forgotten that history, or at least not forgotten it, but at least they're living a conflict right now based on that history. So this is the most common scenario and most common outcome for this condition, if you want. This is what I call a prognosis. The prognosis is fairly good. And as far as therapy, of course, the therapy is to speed up this prognosis to arrive at this outcome. And that requires resistance, of course, from the native people. And we Palestinians have been resisting. I wrote a book called Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. Because I think it is indeed a history of empowerment and hope for the people, a history of success. This is nonviolent resistance that is going on and still continues and has been successful and will speed up arriving at this prognosis, which, as I said, is one country for all its people. There's, by the way, no fourth outcome. No fourth scenario beyond those three scenarios we discussed. For example, there's no scenario where colonial, anti-colonial struggles ended up dividing the country between the colonizers and the colonized, ended up dividing the country between the natives and the occupiers. Two-state solution does not exist in colonial, anti-colonial lexicon.
Is this a condition that happens because it's part of human nature, or do people do it consciously, like the ethnic cleansing? Are they doing it consciously, or is it just part of human nature to take over and to do it without even, it's like an animal instinct?
Well, I was joking that there may be a gene in humans for colonization, because now that we are destroying Earth, they're even talking about colonizing Mars. So I don't know. It's kind of an interesting question. Why do humans have this this notion that they can go to some other country and establish colonies in it and take it over and create a new system, even if the natives of that country don't want it. I mean, I'm thinking here, even the science fiction movies like Avatar was like that, you know, where they speak about, Pandora and the attempt to colonize and take it over and take the natural resources. And so there may be something about humans as higher primates that pushes us in this direction. Now, to accomplish it, of course, the natives are looked at as an obstacle, as a sort of like looking at thorns or stones in the field that you want to cultivate. They are to be removed either by killing or by ethnic cleansing or some mechanism to remove them. Again, this is kind of a natural thing that's associated with colonialism. Not natural in the sense of good or bad, I'm just saying as a descriptive term, it's part of what the humans do and have done historically in hundreds of locations, not just in Palestine. So the way I look at it is, as a scientist, I describe the phenomena. I am not interested in vilifying people or saying good or bad. I mean, one can look at the American colonization and all of this stuff. That's what happened. It's just history, part of history. I may not like it if I'm a native, of course, and I don't like what the Israelis are doing to us as a native. I'm sure from the perspective of the colonizers, it's a different perspective.
So now, is it consciously done, or is it, I have a business idea, I can make a bunch of money if I get that land, I really need to build this whatever I got here, and those people are living there, I need to get them out of there. And it happens like in a little project by little project, sometimes they're big projects, but it happens like little thing after little thing. Or is it consciously planned at a higher level that we need to ethnically cleanse and get these people out of here?
Well, in the case of the Zionist movement, there was very clear plans from the beginning. When Theodor Herzl founded the modern Zionist movement in Basel in 1897, he sent two rabbis to Palestine at the same year to look at the country and see how suitable it is for a Jewish state. And the two rabbis, before they sent their full report, they sent a message by telegram to Herzl. And the telegram in 1897 simply said, "The bride is beautiful, but she is married to another man." In other words, it's a wonderful country for a Jewish state, but there are people here. How are you going to deal with the people? So the answer that Herzl gave, and every leading Zionist gave, was they had to go. And there's plenty of countries around who speak the same language, Arabic, where they can just be pushed to. Whether they like it or not, they had to go. And so that's what there was indeed a program to remove them, to remove my ancestors. My grandmother comes from Nazareth, for example. And so there was an attempted effort to remove the people there. The question is really, again, you know, what does this mean? Is it mean that they were evil? Well, I mean, they were doing business. They were doing a project. The project requires certain things. I mean, Benny Morris, who is a Zionist historian, once wrote, yes, there was some removal of native people. And here's the documents to show this. And he proved it. He's a Zionist. He's committed to the Zionist idea and to colonialism and all this stuff. And he even wrote that maybe we didn't do enough of it. Maybe we should have cleansed more of them, removed more of them. It was just expected. He said we couldn't have a Jewish state any other way. It had to be done. So one could you know, could describe it any way they want to, but I don't like to use words like evil or whatever. It's a business transaction. In the same way, I mean, the slave owners in the South, in the Deep South, for them, slaves were property for picking cotton, for enriching their lives and making their lives comfortable. And from their perspective, it was just business. No more and no less. Many of them were churchgoers. They went to church and prayed for gifts. And many of them, I'm sure, realized that what they were doing is against Christianity, but they continue to do it because it's business.
But do you think business and people, we can talk ourselves into things aren't bad because then we can say, well, it's just business. And so we hide behind business to do things that are evil, because business in itself doesn't have to be evil. It's just a tool like anything else.
What I'm saying is I can describe the situation. Now, if we want to talk about what's right and what's wrong, I think it's obvious.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I teach
slavery was wrong.
I teach ethics at University of Minnesota. I did last year. This year, I'm teaching something else.
Wrong.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But the question is what to do about it. Things that happened in history, you and I cannot undo slavery, for example, that happened. But we can work on the current injustices that are happening right now in America, like Black Lives Matter and the fact that there's a lot of racism in the U.S. and so forth. So there are things that we can work on right now in our time frame that we can work on. And that's why when I started and when you asked me about what you are looking to do, I said what I'm looking to do is to live within my own conscience, to live comfortably in my own skin, basically, to do what I think is right relative to what I can do at this present stage in my own circumstances. And when you ask me about going, for example, from the U.S., coming back to Palestine, giving up a high salary income to come here, it is because my conscience tells me I can do more work here. I can be more useful to suffering people. Even though personally I pay a price, of course. So that's what I would say for every one of us needs to look at their own personal journey, if you want, and what they need to do for their own, to make sure that we challenge to the maximum ability we can challenge things that are unjust, that are irrational, and that ultimately destroy our humanity and our species, if you want. Because all of this is connected, by the way, global warming, wars, conflicts, the economy in the U.S., the economy here, they are all interconnected. So if we connect the dots, we understand that there's a global struggle. And that's the idea behind thinking globally and acting locally.
Well, I think the evolution of the species so that we don't kill ourselves off. We have to be wiser and smarter, which means that we have to be more aware and conscious of the things that we do. We can't just mass abuse people and mass abuse the planet, the people that's on it, just because it's business or just because it's anything else. We have to be smarter about it.
Absolutely. And the question is, if this is our goal and our strategy, what is our tactics? What do we do as individuals or as groups of individuals or as organizations, as universities, whatever? What is our role? And this is a part that we need to be searching for and thinking very, very seriously about. It's not an easy answer, because we may agree, for example, climate change is bad or that the risk of nuclear war is now getting, you know, I don't remember what. Now they now said 1 minute to midnight or 2 minutes to midnight for a nuclear war, which could eliminate Homo sapiens as a species. The question is, what are we going to do with this last 2 or 3 minutes before that midnight? And what is my role? What's your role? How are we as individuals to work on these things? And I, for myself, of course, struggle with this all the time and try to position myself in the area where I can achieve the maximum success for the limited amount of time and resources that I have. And this is a way to address this rationally and objectively, not in wishful thinking and waiting for utopia, but in terms of practical elements to what I need to do right now, today and tomorrow, and in the next few years.
So do you think that in your particular situation in Israel, and someone said this to me, actually is the co-founder of the Venus Project, and it made sense, is that abuse is a cycle. So for example, parents abuse their children, those children grow up and abuse their children. It's a cycle that you have to stop. Israelis have been abused in the past, and creating this country, they're abusing the Palestinians along the way. Now, you framed it in a different sense of colonization, and it's just a pattern. But would you also say that possibly it's a cycle of abuse?
I do not agree with this analogy, if you want, or analysis of for many reasons, which I can go through. But to cut it short, even if I take it as such, anything into accept this logic that there was an abused situation. It's like saying, well, you know, a person who abused his children was abused when he was a child. That's why he abuses his children. So what? It doesn't change the behavior of me towards that person because he still is doing something wrong, which he should be punished for abusing his own children. And the fact that many children who are abused do not grow up to abuse their own children. So it is not an excuse, even if I accept it. We don't, by the way, for many reasons, which I can talk about. One is, I'll give you just a simple thing, is that actually the Zionists who established the State of Israel as a colonial power benefited from great powers, including Germany, under a Nazi regime. And they benefited also directly, and they made deals with Nazi Germany. And they supported Nazi Germany very early on. And the first congratulatory letter to Hitler that came from abroad came from the World Zionist Congress, congratulating him about the racial laws that he put together, which were targeting Jews. And they said, what you are doing here is exactly what we want to do in Palestine. So, no, they were not the ones who were abused.
And
they
that is, very good. So that is a document that you could you, do you have access to that? I could just put it up on screen.
Yes. There's a book, actually, by Lenny Brenner called 51 Documents, the History of the Nazi Zionist Collaboration. I encourage people to read it. It has all these documents of collaborations, including this agreement called the Transfer Agreement. Another author, both of them Jewish, by the way, Lenny Brenner and Edwin Black, wrote a book called The Transfer Agreement about this signed agreement between Hitler and the Zionist movement. So, in my humble opinion, they were interested in a political movement that existed before Hitler and it existed after Hitler. And certainly in the first few years, at least, they collaborated with Hitler. So, but even, as I said, even if we accept that some of the Jews who support Zionism, and indeed some of them do, some of the Jews who suffered under Hitler, who lived in the concentration camps, who either later or during that time became Zionists, became committed to the idea of Zionism. Let's say they did this out of a sense of, you know, that they were suffering and that this is a sense of empowerment and strengthening their position so that they run their own affairs. If we accept this logic, and I'm willing to accept that, I have no problem with it, that they thought that it was good for Jews. Well, the reality is it's not good for Jews. The reality, the objective reality is it's not good for Jews, and it has not been good for Jews. And Nazi Germany was ended in 1945. Since 1945 until today, The biggest cause of anti-Semitism in the world has been the state of Israel and Zionism. And the Jews who are killed in the world, where are they killed? They are killed right here in Palestine, which is now called the state of Israel. So Israel was not a safe haven for Jews. It did not produce safety for Jews. You cannot produce safety by ethnically cleansing another people from their land. This is not a mechanism for safety or for security or for justice or human rights. And never again, when we say never again, should not be never again for Jews only. Should be never again for all human beings. So when Israel commits massacres and destroys Palestinian refugee camps and destroyed 530 Palestinian villages and towns that were wiped off the face of the map, these are Nazi-like tactics, if you want. This is not creating safety for Jews. This is actually the opposite. It's creating danger for Jews. I'm talking objectively, and many Jews agree with me, and hundreds of them have written books about the subject, like Mark Ellis, a Jewish theologian, wrote a book called Out of the Ashes, very important book about these issues and how the issue of never again and all of this stuff. Many, many other Israelis also have written about these issues. For example, there's a guy by the name of Berg, who was the speaker of the Israeli Knesset, Avraham Berg. So he was a Zionist at some point, and now he considers himself a post-Zionist. And he wrote a book also about these issues and how it is not justification for us to use the Holocaust, to continue to use the Holocaust, to justify the oppression and the ethnic cleansing and the destruction of another society.
Well, I think that I love that when you say, you know, if you're abused, does not give you an excuse to abuse somebody else. The Holocaust does not give you an excuse to abuse somebody else. Colonization doesn't give you an excuse to abuse someone else. Business doesn't give you an excuse to abuse someone else. But can you explain what Zionism is separate from what being Jewish is? Because a lot of people get confused and think that Zionism and being Jewish is the same thing, and it's not.
Very good question. Zionism as a political movement came about in the mid-19th century. It was actually, the word was coined in 1860 or so. And it was adopted by groups of people like Pinsker and others who developed the idea for Zionism as an idea partially in response to the anti-Semitism in Europe in the 19th century, that there was anti-Semitism, there was hatred of Jews, and let us Jews think of a solution to this quote-unquote Jewish problem by going and creating our own Jewish state in Palestine. This was the origin of the movement. It was not a very successful movement. Most Jews did not believe in it. Herzl was brilliant in 1897. When he took this movement that his father belonged to also, and he built it as an actual political movement. And so the actual organizational structure, if you read about the first Zionist Congress in 1897, their program was very clear. We need Jewish empowerment. We need Jews to run their own affairs, to have their own sovereign state, etc. And they chose Palestine for obvious reasons, that it's possible to rally the masses for it. They even considered places like Argentina and Angola to do it in, which are less populated than Palestine at the time. But they settled on Palestine because they argued that that's how we can mobilize enough Jews to so-called return to Palestine. And they articulated its mission as being empowerment of Jews, return of Jews to Palestine, creation of a Jewish state with Jewish government. This is the articulation in their own words, not my own articulation. I'm talking about their own vision of things. To do this, of course, they understood that there's a country called Palestine. it had people here, and the tiny minority of people here were Jews. 3% were Jewish here, Jewish Palestinians. And so they understood what it means in terms of removing the native people. They didn't actually give it much thought. They wrote about removing them. Herzl said, we will spirit the penniless population across the border, spirit them, like send them away, you know. And so this is the notions that they developed. And then since 1897, the second best articulation of Zionist visions came in the Jerusalem Zionist Convention of 1966, which is the last major World Zionist Congress meeting. In 1966, they reiterated those principles. They added a couple more, like strengthening the Hebrew language, which they had reintroduced in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and institutions and protecting Jews around the world who need our protection, in their words, and things like that. But this is the vision that they put, and it's a vision that's very, very clear to them, and it's very clear certainly to the Palestinian natives here and to everybody else who wants it.
Now, Zionism has been expanded. People are saying that the Zionists have global aspirations. Is that something that you've seen?
Well, when Zionists started their project, Herzl articulated it very beautifully, and so did Ben-Gurion. They said in the 1920s, Ben-Gurion, for example, wrote about this, that we couldn't do this on our own as people, as Jews in Palestine, even with the help of some Jews abroad. We couldn't do it on our own. We need to rally world governments and influence world governments to achieve this. So they set out to lobby the world governments to achieve what they wanted to do. And the first government they lobbied, by the way, was the Ottoman Empire in the late 19th century. And they succeeded, by the way. And the Ottoman Empire supported Zionism first, until we Palestinians objected and had nonviolent demonstrations, and the Ottoman Sultan changed his views. So then the World Zionist Congress moved its headquarters from Vienna, which was closer to the Ottoman Empire. They moved it to London in 1904 because they wanted to lobby the British government and the French governments, and those were the center, the two major powers at the time, the French Empire and the British Empire in 1904. And it took them 13 years, by the way, to get official support from those governments in the form of public declarations. In the case of the British government, called the Balfour Declaration 1917. But there was also the parallel French Declaration 1917, also called Jules Cambon Declaration from the French government. So they got the French and the British government support, and then they moved on to get the American support starting in 1918. And they succeeded, of course, with the support of the American government to the British Mandate of Palestine and to the Balfour Declaration. And then they established the lobbying powers in the U.S. like AIPAC and other powers. So I'm sorry for the long answer, but in short, if I want to summarize, is yes, of course, they understood the value, Zionists understood the value of lobbying and influencing governments and buying governments in some cases, or pressuring them, or using tactics of, threatening governments even to get their way. And they have succeeded in many of these aspects. That's why Western governments today, many of them support the State of Israel, even against their own interests, against their own Western government interests, and certainly against international law and against human rights.
Are there big powers behind the Zionist movement, big money powers? You said that they're established in London, but is there big money powers behind the establishment or behind the Zionist movement?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean by money power. I mean, certainly there are very wealthy Zionist Jews that support the Zionist movement. There are also some Jews who don't support the Zionist movement and who even donate money and large sums of money to effect a change towards human rights, towards international law, and so forth. I don't want to exaggerate the power of, you know, it's not this cabal that rules the world or anything. Although they themselves want to project this, they want the world to think that they have invincible powers. They want people like Donald Trump and Obama and others to think that the Zionist movement is invincible and can sink their presidency or can allow them to be elected or not elected. I think they exaggerate their own power for this purpose. But at the same time, you know, they are a lobby just as much as the industrial and military lobbies in the U.S. are lobbies that affect U.S. policy, for example. And certainly sometimes the industrial military complex wins against the Zionist lobby in the U.S. and sometimes they lose against the Zionists. And I can give you examples of these things where sometimes they win, sometimes they lose.
Well, a lot of people believe the Zionist lobby is the most powerful in the United States, and they have a significant control of our government.
I don't know, you know, how you measure the most powerful lobby. I don't know what the most powerful lobby in the U.S. is. But certainly, if I put the 5 or 10 biggest lobbies in the U.S., the gun lobby, the elderly people lobby, the military lobby, the union lobbies, the industrial lobbies, and the Israeli lobby, they all come in that 5, 6, 7 top lobbyists in the U.S. But I don't know which one of them is more powerful. Most of the time, they work on separate issues, so you cannot measure their effect relative to each other. But when they work on the same issue, if their interests collide, then you can tell which one was more powerful at that moment. So, for example, there were periods when the military lobby lost in the U.S. to the Israeli lobby. And there were times when they won against the Israeli lobby. The oil industry the same way. Sometimes they win against the Israeli lobby and sometimes they lose. So relative strength, maybe we could count how many times they lost against each other, and then based on that, we can tell which is more powerful. But that can also fluctuate from year to year, so it's hard to say. Maybe one would be more powerful in the 1970s and less powerful in the 1980s, for example.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay. Puts things more in perspective for people when they kind of think that somebody's has more power than they do, or to see that they do really do have a lot of power. Let's talk about the Palestinians. What do the Palestinians do that is contributing to their problem? I mean, they're rejecting. Is there anything they can do to get it to be in that third colonization situation where the two groups are just living side by side harmoniously?
The problem with looking at it in the perspective, what should the native people do? The problem is, with that perspective, is that the colonizing power has an agenda to accomplish. They move along the margins of this agenda, of course, partially influenced by what the native people do, but ultimately they have goals to achieve that are not negotiable for them. In the case of, let's say, the European colonizers in North America, they came claiming that they want to escape persecution, establish, manifest destiny, God put us there, establishing civilization, bringing music, culture, Christianity to this backward society, etc. Now, how the natives responded is variable. And one thing, it's very easy to say, well, the natives should do ABC. Well, they cannot, because the natives are people, and they have different responders. So some natives choose to collaborate and be trackers for the white people. Some natives choose to resist by arms. Some natives choose to resist by non-arms. And these different tactics of the natives only affects the tactics that are used by the colonizers. They do not affect the overall strategy of the colonizers. So when the colonizers, for example, signed treaties with the Native Americans, these were tactics. And when the time expired, they broke the treaties and moved on. They had the strategy. The strategy is bigger than these tactics of signing a treaty or not signing a treaty. The same applies to the issue of colonialism here. It really, if, you know, by magic, which cannot happen because any colonization, colonized people, they always resist in a bell-shaped curve, most of it nonviolent, of course, some of it collaboration on one side, some of it armed on the other side, but it's a bell-shaped curve. There is a bigger bell-shaped curve of violence from the colonizers. That's why always the ratio of colonized killed to colonizers killed is 10 to 1. So 10 times more native people are killed for every one person who is of the colonizers who is killed.
What can the Jewish...
My point is, even if magically one can think of the natives suddenly all becoming too docile or completely docile, which is impossible, of course, because any kind of theft, destruction, killing is faced by resistance. But let's say that magically the natives, Native Americans or Native South Americans or Brazilians, Native Aztec, natives anywhere, they decided collectively, which is impossible, to all become Mother Teresa's. What is this going to do? It would not change a thing. Would not change a thing. It would still be a system that is intent on creating a new system that excludes the natives. Because the system of colonization is not interested in equalizing with the natives or organizing the natives to be part of the system. They are interested in removing the natives and creating a new system for themselves.
Well, when colonies came to the point where they were living together, what is it? Is it that you guys are stuck in the early stages of this process and can't get to that next stage of just living together, or is it? I mean, why can't this move along to a more healthy, peaceful state?
It does, actually. It is moving in that direction.
Oh, it is. Good.
And as I said, for most countries that live in a colonial, anti-colonial struggle, that's the outcome. The outcome is for people, the third scenario we talked about, is for people to live in one country, to share the country and share its resources. We Palestinians, by the way, are not against immigrants. We were immigrants from other countries all along. When the Armenians came after the Armenian Holocaust, for example, in 1914, not only did we welcome them and they became equal citizens with us, we even gave them a quarter of our capital. A quarter of Jerusalem is called the Armenian Quarter. Why? It's a quarter of a city that we gave it to immigrants. We said, Ahlan wa sahlan, welcome. We're not against immigrants. We are against somebody who wants to remove us and create a system where they run the country the way they like. This is what we are against, and that's what most natives are against. So here we are moving in that direction of the third scenario, and actually we are moving successfully. And I think Zionism is already lost as a colonial movement. The question then becomes really, when do they realize that they have lost as a colonial movement? Not in terms of what the Palestinians do or don't do, or for that matter, what the international community does or does not do. We Palestinians and the international community can help our neighbors, the Israelis, get rid of the mental occupation, which is more dangerous to them, by the way, than anything else. The mental occupation of being occupiers, of being colonizers. When they free their mind, that's when they also become free like us. And I consider us actually more free than they are. They are more occupied by the system that they created, they being the segment who still remains committed to Zionism. A big segment, by the way, is no longer committed to Zionism and is moving in the direction of integration and a secular democratic state for all its people. But there is still a segment that thinks of Zionism as somehow good for Jews. And it is not good for Jews. It's something that is very harmful for Jews. It's very harmful for their psychology, for their history, for their future. In all aspects, it's something that's not good for them.
Well, what would you see it look like as far as when you know you've gotten to that point? Would the Giza, it's like a prison cell almost, like walls up so people can't move about. Will you see that being completely torn down and people can just freely, it becomes more of a free whole country for all its people?
Well, I mean, I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa very briefly and very little, actually, from my part in 1980-81. And in that period, you know, what was our vision for South Africa? Our vision was that whites and blacks live in one country, one man, one vote, equality, justice for all. It didn't quite pan out like this. There's still economic apartheid in South Africa. But this is the vision. It's human rights, basically. And this is the vision for all post-colonial struggles, is to have human rights. There is something called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1949. Most countries have signed on to it, but few countries respect it. The United States and Israel even signed on to it, but they don't respect it. And I would say if we want a roadmap to peace here, just take that Universal Declaration of Human Rights and implement it. It's a very simple, very beautiful, eloquent document. Talks about no discrimination based on religion. People have a right to live in their own country, not to be ethnically cleansed. Refugees would have a right to return to their homes and lands. No walls, no segregation. This is the vision that I think most people agree with and understand intuitively and understand logically if you analyze it and look at it. So the question is, why don't we work for it? Is the only thing. And what's the mechanisms that we can work to achieve it?
Well, how can people learn more about your work? Because I know you're doing fantastic work there to get it to more to that point. How can people learn more about that work, and how can people support it? Because a lot of people don't even think there's anything they can do.
There's a lot that people can do. I wrote some books. If people want to learn a little bit of history, they can read my books or other books like Edward Said or Ilan Pape or, many, many Israelis have written books that Avish Lame, for example, the books I mentioned earlier in the show, like Benny Morris and Benny Morris and Lenny Brenner, many, many other books that are available there. So one should first acquire knowledge, because knowledge is power. In terms of action, which is important also, because knowledge without action doesn't mean very much on the ground. In terms of action, there are many, many ways that people can act with us. There's movements around the world, including for boycott, divestment, sanctions, just like we did with South African apartheid. To subject the apartheid state of Israel to these actions of nonviolent resistance like BDS. People could work on the media, they could work on their politicians, etc. Let me say something, and I like U.S. history in terms of looking at it from the perspective of the people. There's a book by Howard Zinn called The People's History of the United States. And if you read that and you read the real history of the United States, not the one that's in school textbooks or that the propaganda of the government likes us to read, like Thanksgiving being a holiday about Indians and cowboys getting together and eating some corn. If you read the real history of the United States, you realize that it's a history of empowerment by people. If you think of all the positive things that happened in the United States, civil rights movement, ending the war in Vietnam, 40-hour work week, ending U.S. support for apartheid South Africa, and all these hundreds of other things I could list that are positive in U.S. history, how did we get them? How did we arrive at them? We didn't arrive at them because we sat and we contemplated how bad the universe is. We acquired them because the people acted. And the people need to act. And they know instinctively what to do to act. And I'm grateful for the Occupy movements, for example, and the movements now, you know, that are around the racism that is rearing its ugly head in the U.S. All of these things people can act on, and they can move, and they can find ways to act in their own sphere with their own interests. I tell people, even if you're a musician, you can use music for resistance. If you're an artist, you can paint for resistance. If you're a poet, you can be a media person for resistance. Whatever you do, just use your skills to achieve what the change in society that we need to achieve. Walk the walk, don't just walk the talk. I want to just tell you briefly, I mean, my wife and I are now full-time volunteers at the Museum of Natural History and the Palestine Institute of Biodiversity and Sustainability. And this institute is intended to strengthen Native people resistance. The website is palestinenature.org. People can check it out. There's even a video about our work. And our work as a form of resistance, our work as a form of persistence in a positive way. It's not enough to just go out and demonstrate and, you know, carry signs and say, hey, I don't like the system, you know. We have to provide an alternative vision for us, for humans, to live sustainably in our environment, to live together, to respect each other. The motto for this museum is respect. Respect for ourselves first, because without respecting ourselves, we cannot respect others. And that's the second level, is respect for others, whether they are Jewish, Christian, Muslim. My family, for example, is Palestinian Christian family. My wife is Chinese American. She family is Buddhist. You know, I live with Muslim people here. You know, my son got his education in the U.S. You know, my sister went to Utah and became a Mormon even. I have cousins who converted to Islam. We live together. We work together. So that's respect for other people. And third comes the respect for the environment and Mother Earth and protecting Mother Earth. These are the three levels of respect that we Palestinians here at the Palestine Museum of Natural History and at the University of Bethlehem, where I teach, and Beer Zeit University, where I also teach, are interested in developing. And for that, we seek the support of the international community, and certainly your support would be much appreciated. People could come and volunteer here. We have me and my wife are both full-time volunteers, 7 days a week. We're here 10, 12, 15 hours a day sometimes. And other people here internationally, if they come, we provide them with housing and food, so it's a good deal if they want, like a paid vacation if you want.
Well, how do they, so, is there a website they can go to, or do they contact you directly, or how does that work?
Yeah, everything is on our website, palestinenature.org, one word, palestinenature.org.
Okay, excellent.
Thank you.
That's all we have for today, folks. Be sure to check out my website, sarahwestall.com, for all my past episodes. And of course, if you're enjoying this material, please support the program at patreon.com under Sarah Westall. And for now, everybody have an amazing day.